The Music Business Worldwide podcast is supported by Volley Music, a leading financial management platform for the music industry. Volley enables you to track expenses, approve invoices, and make payments 24/7, 365 days a year. For your free trial, head to volleymusic.com. That's VOLYmusic.com.
Hello and welcome to the latest Music Business Worldwide podcast supported by Volley Entertainment. Joining me on this podcast is Temi Adeniji, the Managing Director of Warner Music Africa. Temi is also the SVP of Sub-Saharan Africa at Warner and leads several special projects at the company. Africa, specifically Sub-Saharan Africa, is already a major global music industry story with huge potential for the future. On the music-making side of things, the continent has produced global hits and superstars in recent years, including the likes of Burna Boy from Nigeria, CK also from Nigeria, Tyler from South Africa, and many more. As Temi points out in our discussion, the influence of African nations on modern music goes far beyond this, however, especially when you take into account genres such as Afrobeats and Amapiano. Temi, who is based in Johannesburg, has been instrumental in a number of initiatives from Warner Music Group in Africa in recent years, including Warner's partnership in Nigeria with Chocolate City, signed in 2019, as well as its acquisition of distributor Afrikori in 2022, and other deals, such as Warner's partnership with East African artist Diamond Platinum and his label WCB Wasafi in 2021. On these and other deals, Temi has worked closely with Warner's president of emerging markets, Alfonso Perez Soto, who she mentions a number of times in our discussion. Temi hasn't always been Africa-based. She was born in Nigeria, but moved to the US as a child, where she later graduated from Princeton University and then Columbia University before building a successful career in law. She then joined Warner Music Group in New York in 2016, working across international strategy and operations before relocating for her current job in Johannesburg in 2021. On this podcast, Temi discusses the potential of various African markets, both in terms of the music being made there and in terms of commerce. I also ask her about Warner's own strategy in the region and the general commercial excitement surrounding nations like Nigeria, where, as an example, Universal Music Group recently made a nine-figure investment into Maven Records. Temi Adeniji, welcome to the MBW podcast. Your role sees you run Warner Music across Africa with continued responsibility for Sub-Saharan Africa. I know that was your original remit. Obviously, Africa's music scene is much more diverse than quote-unquote Afrobeats. We're going to get into that, I'm sure, a number of times in this topic. Since you took the job in 2021, what have been the two, maybe three biggest territorial stories in music across the continent? I mean, we hear all the time, obviously, about the Afrobeat story, but I'm sure there's much more to Africa than that. Which two or three stories stand out in that time frame to you, musically speaking?
Sure. I think the first one is just like pervasive global hits coming from the continent over the last 3-4 years. So in 2020, you had Jerusalema, which is from South Africa, an artist called Master KG. And then you had CK in 2021, 2022 with Love Wantiti, and then Rema with Calm Down 2022, 2023. And then the most recent being Tyla with Water and winning the Grammy so early on in her career. And I think what you see is like just a consistent growth story here. So each of those songs was bigger than the previous one. And I think what that speaks to is just how fervent sort of the appetite for music from the continent is from across the world. I think for us, we kind of saw this ahead of time. I think a lot of the industry had been talking about Afrobeats for a really long time, but we really started to see the numbers in the last couple of years. And I think that's been really encouraging. The second thing I think is just the rise of Amapiano. I think since 2019, Amapiano has really come through as commercially one of the continent's biggest exports. It is a South African music genre for those who don't know. And a lot of the streams, much like a lot of the content from the continent, is really seeing huge growth in Europe and in Asia and in North America. I think between 2019 and 2023, there was an over sort of 500% growth on Spotify with respect to the genre. And I think that, again, comes to just being rooted in dance and rhythm. The genre is super versatile. There's been some discussion around the fact that a lot of sort of Nigerian Afrobeats was co-opting the amapiano sort of structure, especially using the log drum in the past couple of years. And it's been a lot of times seen from a negative light. But I think there is some positivity along with that. I think it is great to see artists being influenced by each other from across the continent. Being a Pan-African, I think there's something really powerful about that story. As long as the credit gets placed where it's deserved, I think it's a great story to show all the different parts of the continent really being influenced by each other to create something really extraordinary. So for me, those are the two main things that have really cut through as really, really amazing stories from the continent since I've taken this role.
Thank you. You mentioned, I believe, two South African artists and two Nigerian artists, and the Nigerian artists being Rema and CK there. I wanted to ask you specifically about Nigeria. Maybe I should ask you specifically about South Africa as well following this. I would say the biggest story from the sort of export position, I'm London-based, as you know, but out of sub-Saharan Africa continues to be Nigeria, both in terms of domestic trade revenue, so the IFPI numbers, etc., and those cultural exports that you talk about. We've also had Burna Boy and Wizkid and all many, many artists I'm sure I'm not even aware of. But when you look at Nigeria today specifically, which I know was in your remit, how much bigger can its story get in music, both domestically and globally?
Yeah, I often say that I think what we're witnessing right now is just a recalibration of what it means to create pop music. So I don't necessarily see it as just music from Nigeria. I see the artists and the creatives from Nigeria really influencing what pop music means today. I think you're seeing that across a bunch of different regions. So Latin music is obviously having its moment and has been having a moment over the past couple years. And I think all it means is that it's just not going to be an Anglo-based idea of pop, and everything is going to become mixed in. You'll have influences from India, Latin America, Africa, and all these sounds from all these different places will really become part of this pop milieu. And I think that's where we're going. I think we're moving to a place where the sounds are really democratized. As I was saying previously, artists are influencing each other, genres are taking inspiration from other genres, and it's all just what pop music is seen as. But I think for me, the most important thing to note is that Africa will be playing a very big role in this evolution of what pop is. So I do think that the story is big now, but I think it's going to be really not as easy to sort of erase the influence of Africa and Nigeria specifically in terms of shaping how people are consuming music or the type of music that people are consuming or what people want to hear and et cetera.
I guess part of that is, I nodded to it in the question there, but if we just stick with Nigeria for a second, and please relate this to other territories within Africa if relevant, it's actually the economic impact that the country itself, that music listeners in the country itself will have on the global music industry, not just the cultural and musical influence, but actually the commercial influence. The IFPI talks much about sub-Saharan Africa. They have recently said that trade revenues grew 20% plus over the past 2 years. It's a really hot territory. What needs to happen within sub-Africa? Obviously, there's going to be different challenges and opportunities in the markets, but from your perspective, are there headlines that needs to happen domestically to accelerate the commercial potential of the region?
Okay, so I'll frame this question a bit by giving a few numbers, and then I'll come to what I think needs to happen or how I see these things sort of rolling out. So Sub-Saharan Africa, as you said, experienced over 20% growth. It's valued about $92 million, which is approximately $20 million year-on-year growth. It is the only region to exceed the 20%. It is a very low base, so always keep that sort of in mind. As it stands, there are about 40 million subscribers, both paid and free, across all the different platforms. In Sub-Saharan Africa, South Africa is the largest market, around 77% of the regional revenues. And then Nigeria is around 9 million, which is about 45% growth from the previous year. Really zoning in on that 40 million subscribers number, if you think about the population of Sub-Saharan Africa being about 1.2 billion, we have about 3% penetration. That's not even sort of scratching the surface of what the potential is here. I was thinking about it, and if we get to a 30% penetration with everyone paying an approximate value of sort of 50 cents, we will have an additional over $160 million in revenue for the industry. And that is super significant. So I think when we think about the territory, we really think about the potential that we can see if we continue to see even what I would say is modest growth, but obviously is exponential growth for that, for the region. And so I guess taking it back to your initial question, I think my experience has revealed sort of two main obstacles to achieving scale. One is just underdeveloped music ecosystem in terms of PROs and CMOs. And then the second is obviously data costs, which I talk about all the time. As far as like CMOs and PROs, sort of South Africa is the only sort of country in the region with sophisticated and effective organizations that are doing collections. And most of the other countries are plagued with CMOs and PROs are in competition against each other. There's mismanagement, et cetera. It's really problematic because it really does distort the value of the industry. And it also means that artists and right holders, they don't have a functioning apparatus through which to get paid fairly. So I think for me, that is probably one of the most important sort of barriers to growing the domestic market. Both of these conditions with the data and the CMOs really exacerbate the issue of this being an export-driven market. In and of itself, that's not a problem, but I think it really means that countries outside of the territory wield an outsized power over the continent, even if it's covert. You know what I mean? So I think for me, having a functional regulatory edifice has both implications for the industry, but also like sociocultural implications in terms of how artists can approach making the music. I don't know if that makes sense. And then I think the other is just the importance of reduced data costs, which the last time we talked about, I talked about this. And I like to think about this in the context of my experience in India. So between 2017 and 2019, I worked really closely under Stu Bergen with Alfonso to start to map out what our strategy in India was going to be. So I took a number of trips to India. And that really revealed to me the main factor that underpinned the rapid increase of the consumption in India was an extraordinary countrywide campaign. And I guess going into a little bit of the nitty-gritty, India first got high-speed internet in around the early 2010s and largely at a pretty standard pace. But then in 2016, you had Kesha Ambani of Reliance Jio offered customers 4 gigs of data for free for 6 months. And the results were really dramatic. Within 6 months of the launch, India became a top mobile data user. So for me, I use this as a marker for Africa. Because I think when I was there, I was like, oh, wow, this is gave me a little bit of hope about where the continent could go, but also gave a view of how important it was for this campaign to expedite the growth of the Indian market from a telecoms perspective, but also impacted music because you had folks in villages who had never had access to data now being able to access data in the internet age, and surfing the internet became sort of buying a cup of tea, if you will. I think I was really given a lot of hope, like I said, about this fact, but I remember kind of talking to a really good friend of mine, the MD of Spotify, Jocelyn Muhuturemi, about this. And she was like, well, you have to remember the difference between sub-Saharan Africa and India is population density. So in my mind, I was like, well, we just need the countries to come together and do something like what Reliance Jio did for India. But the cost of putting something like that in place in somewhere like sub-Saharan Africa is astronomical compared to India. Because if you look at just the physical space of sub-Saharan Africa versus India, it's just so much larger. And so you're looking at a population density of about 40 per square kilometer in sub-Saharan Africa versus 470 per square kilometer. So you can do the math as to how difficult it would be to actually put something like that in place in Africa. So there are a number of different sort of factors that make it really challenging to basically increase internet penetration and to reduce the costs of data. But I do think that is still super important in terms of expediting and making the content, the sub-Saharan region's adoption of streaming much faster, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. I'm going out on a bit of a limb here because I'm not nowhere near as educated as you. But if I just look at the Reliance store in India, I think I'm right in saying, like, obviously, they didn't give away 3G and then I think 4G internet you made reference to, the 6 month free. They didn't give that away for fun or through altruism, right? And I think they gave away mobile phones to try and capture the data and be the first to capture the data. So is it the case that in sub-Saharan Africa or Nigeria or certain regions of Africa, you just need some commercial vision there because Reliance has harvested that data and made oodles of profit out of that early investment. And I'm sure that the similar opportunity is waiting there in sub-Saharan Africa for the right company.
No, 100%. I mean, I think there is a commercial view here. And I think it would have to be a domestic demand-led strategy that's driving sort of countries to work together or to drive a private entity to take this step. But I do think that if you just look at the numbers that I had said earlier, if we have 30% penetration, how much more value it would bring to the industry, you can imagine any entity that decides to take this on, the upside that they would be able to see from this. And obviously, as you said, they're not altruists or whatever, but I do think that there are positive results of something like that in terms of democratizing access to information, access to music, which I think is a good thing.
100%. I mean, to a degree, the motivations of the accelerant matters less than the impact. And I completely buy into what you were saying before about if the domestic countries become more commercially powerful, that even trickles down to the mindset of the artists making the music, because they're not just thinking about, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if one day this took off in the United States? If you have a strong domestic market, it makes all the difference to especially the early years of an artist. I want to talk about Warner. Let's talk about Warner specifically for a second. What in your mind differentiates Warner's strategy in Africa from your perspective from the competitors? I guess when I say competitors, it gets tricky, but I guess I'm talking about global competitors, the global multinational music companies. What differentiates Warner's strategy from your perspective?
Sure. And by the way, I mean, non-global competitors are also getting really interested in the territory and have invested quite a lot of money. So everything is, all of them are important. But I will say that I have no idea how our strategy is different from our competitors, because we don't focus on the competitors. We just focus on what our strategy is and what it isn't. So I can tell you that we, and by that I mean myself and Alfonso, started crafting the strategy for Africa around 2017. We were really late movers, but we were clear that in order to make up for the lost time, we wanted to really focus on finding fit for purpose businesses already operating on ground. And so in the last couple of years, we've covered a lot of ground via accretive investments, which have given us a really great foundation to become real players in the market. We always engage in a thoughtful and inventive way, and we don't really try to worry too much about what everyone else is doing. Our strategy was definitely not to just open new offices. It's always been to take the time to work with local partners, AfriCore, Chocolate City, Ziki, and really understand the different markets and the different scenes, and to view of just having a long haul perspective. So we really wanted to learn as much as we can and add as much value as we could. But yeah, I think we've done a really great job of that. Part of my coming here was a full circle moment around what we had planned from 2017. We'd made several different investments. And then in 2021 was me coming to try to start bringing things together and lay a real foundation for what we could build on top of. And that's where we kind of are now. So I think we've just been taking it bit by bit, really focusing on region by region. There's no sort of one size fits all approach, as it's a hugely diverse region with different cultures, languages, with all really exciting local music scene. We've got East Africa, you've got Tanzania, Kenya there, you've got Nigeria, Ghana, and in West Africa, South Africa, Zim. There's just so much richness in terms of the culture. And I think we've always tried to have a view of that as we've been moving forward in order to build really commercial plans that take into account all these idiosyncrasies.
You've mentioned this before, and I've heard other people mention this as well. I can't profess to having intimate knowledge of this period of the music industry in Africa, but I've heard that there was a period in the past where the major music companies were seen to have swept in to the continent and they staffed up and invested, and then they ended up folding down their operations. And obviously that can be quite damaging, that kind of rushing in investment and then closing down. What's different about that era? I think we're going back decades to talk about that era versus this era. You mentioned Warner's investment, so Chocolate City and AfriCore to pick two, but also we saw Universal recently make a major investment, a majority acquisition, I believe, of Mavin. Do you have more confidence in this era of multinational music company investment in the region than that we have seen in the past?
Yeah, I definitely think the approach is different now. Previously, it was to just come here, set up shop, and really take. And I think where it's different now is like with the view of actually investing in entrepreneurs who've taken a lot of risk to build businesses that are in a really challenging environment, rewarding them for that sort of approach. I think that's definitely something that's a positive. I think a lot of the majors and players in the market work very closely with the IFPI. And I think organizations like the IFPI are super important in trying to actually build on ground. I sit on the Sub-Saharan African Committee, and through that, we've actually set up charts in South Africa and then most recently Nigeria. And these don't seem like a huge deal, but it really, for me, is these are the brass and the bolts, nuts and bolts of
what it means to have a functional sort of music industry. And as we work together, I think that we can really cut through and build something that's more sustainable than what it was last time, because that was by and large completely only export driven from both commercial and also from a cultural perspective. Whereas now there is some focus on trying to build on ground and trying to make sure there are organizations on ground that are trying to ensure that this system or this industry is working appropriately. It's a huge area, so we try not to boil the ocean, try to take it one piece at a time. Like I said, first South Africa with the charts and then Nigeria. But it is, I think, step by step, we're getting there. And I definitely think there are more positive developments that would seem to prove that this is a bit different than the last time.
There's been a couple of stats. I'll make this the last question because I think this is going to take us in a couple of directions probably. But there's been a couple of stats recently about non-English language music or artists based in territories where English isn't the primary language. So the first stat was from Luminate, and that showed that 55% of the top 10,000 tracks globally in terms of streaming last year were English language. So we're getting close to parity now. 45% were non-English language. And that was down from 67% a couple of years previously. There was also a stat, I don't have it in front of me, but I'll plug it out of the air, from Spotify recently that said a certain proportion of artists, I believe it was over half of artists who are earning over $10,000 from Spotify globally lived outside of territories where English was the primary language. Now, obviously, those artists' music can catch fire in a US or a UK or a Europe or what have you. But that was the statistic. I believe it was over half. So it looks inevitable, just going back to the Luminate stats, that non-English language tracks or tracks that are performed in a language that isn't English will become the majority of the top 10,000 tracks in 2024. So we could be looking at a milestone year. How are these kind of statistics, from your perspective, changing the global music business? And what opportunities do they open up from the seat that you're in, I suppose?
Yeah, I think my previous role, I was looking after all of international from a strategic and strategy and operations perspective. And we started looking at this in Europe around the 2016, 2017 mark, where you were seeing a huge shift from consumption of Western and English content in countries like Italy, Germany, France, really moving over to more local language consumption. So these indicators have been happening for over now almost 8-9 years. And now you're starting to see it with the penetration of music from all these different emerging markets regions. I think it's a trend that, like I said, we started to see and really think about in Europe. And it's a process that I often refer to as the great de-Westification. But it goes back to, I think, what I was saying about the recalibration of what it means to create pop music. I think in terms of influence, you're seeing countries with huge demographic numbers, just huge populations, really starting to really have their time of day and really starting to influence and show the influence of other markets that are non-Anglo. From my seat, something that I've been keenly aware of, and it's something that I think is a great thing. I think it just shows the diversity around the world. I think when different regions are taking influence from other regions, I think it's a fantastic thing. I think it's the impetus for why I decided to pack up from New York and move out to Joburg to sit in the continent, because I do think I wanted to be part of that story. I think it's a really powerful story. I think it's a writing of decades or a huge amount of time where Western and Anglo content has been really dominant, which is just where we were. But I think we're starting to see a shift. And I think that shift is more reflective of where the world is and what the world has to offer from a global perspective. So I think it's amazing. I'm grateful to be part of this story. I'm grateful that I was able to get this opportunity sitting down with Alfonso in 2017 to where we are today. I think even with the company, the view of Africa and the emerging markets has completely shifted. There's a huge amount of focus on these territories as real growth areas. So I think it's amazing.
Tammy Adeniji, thank you for joining me on the Music Business Worldwide podcast.
Thank you for having me, Tim. Appreciate it.